In July 1924, while she was hard at work on her novel Mrs. Dalloway, Virginia Woolf published a short pamphlet which she called Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown. In it, she imagines a group of people travelling with her in a railway carriage. By chance, the group includes three of the most important novelists of the day, H.G. Wells, John Galsworthy, and Arnold Bennett. In the same carriage as these illustrious literary gentlemen, Woolf imagines one more passenger, a woman she describes as ordinary Mrs. Brown. Woolf inserts herself as a young author into this spoof, trying to write about Mrs. Brown. To help her, she sketches the way the established novelists might go about this. Let's hear what she has to say. Mr. Wells would instantly project upon the window pane a vision of a better, breezier, jollier, happier, more adventurous and gallant world, where these musty railway carriages and fusty old women do not exist, where miraculous barges bring tropical fruit to Camberwell by 8 o'clock in the morning, where there are public nurseries, fountains and libraries, dining rooms, drawing rooms and marriages, where every citizen is generous and candid, manly and magnificent, and rather like Mr. Wells himself. And what would Mr. Galsworthy see? Can we doubt that the walls of Dalton's factory would take his fancy? There are women in that factory who make 25 dozen earthenware pots every day. There are mothers in the Mile End Road who depend upon the farthings which those women earn. But there are employers in Surrey who are even now smoking rich cigars while the nightingale sings. Burning with indignation, stuffed with information, arraigning civilization, Mr. Galsworthy would only see in Mrs. Brown a pot broken on the wheel and thrown into the corner. Mr. Bennet, alone of the Edwardians, would keep his eyes in the carriage. He indeed would observe every detail with immense care. He would notice the advertisements, the pictures of Swanage and Portsmouth, the way in which the cushion bulged between the buttons, how Mrs. Brown wore a brooch which had cost 3 and 10 at Whitworth's Bazaar and had mended both gloves. Indeed, the thumb of the left-hand glove had been replaced. Though Woolf's struggle with the difficulties and requirements of writing in this pamphlet plunge her into confusion, there's one thing she's sure of. None of the established novelists of her day get close to the woman Mrs. Brown, Woolf imagines, sitting opposite in the present tense of that rail journey. Their accounts, even the most laudable, are written from their own standpoint. In her pamphlet, Woolf contrasts these Edwardians with a new Georgian generation, novelists like D.H. Lawrence and E.M. Forster, whose experiments with writing have led to what she describes, and I quote, as a breaking and falling, crushing and destruction. It's in this essay that Woolf coins the famous phrase that, and I quote, on or about December 1910, human character changed. Scholarship has offered many explanations as to what might have prompted this phrase. The exhibition of Manet and the Post-Impressionists, curated at the Grafton Gallery in London by her friend Roger Fry, which ran throughout December 1910 and which brought the question of viewpoint centre stage, is one. But when it's a question of Woolf's lifelong quest to convey the truth about human beings, Freud is rarely absent. There's a seat here if you'd like it. It's not too close. Virginia Woolf's relationship to Freud is both well documented and contentious. Freud's ideas were certainly in circulation in England by 1910, as John Forrester has observed. D.H. Lawrence, the new generation novelist Wolfe names in her pamphlet Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Brown, knew of Freud's work through his German wife, Frieda. Knowledge of the Oedipus complex informed his revision of Sons and Lovers in 1912. Leonard Wolfe, Virginia's husband, read Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams and reviewed his The Psychopathology of Everyday Life in 1914. 1914 also saw the founding of the British Society for the Study of Sex Psychology. It seems to have been through what Wolfe describes as her friend Lytton Strachey's agreeable report of a meeting of this society that Wolfe first became interested in Freud. Here is her diary entry for Monday, January the 21st, 1918. Lytton gave us an amazing account of the British Sex Society, which meets at Hampstead. The sound would suggest a third variety of human being, and it seems that the audience had that appearance. Notwithstanding, they were surprisingly frank, and 50 people of both sexes and various ages discussed without shame such questions as the deformity of Dean Swift's penis, whether cats use the WC, self-abuse, incest. Incest between parent and child when they are both unconscious of it was their main theme derived from Freud. I think of becoming a member. Elizabeth Abel's book, Virginia Woolf and the Fictions of Psychoanalysis, published in 1989, gives one of the fullest accounts of Virginia Woolf's relationship to Freud. Abel quotes the anthropologist Bronislaw Malinowski's grumble that psychoanalysis in the period after the First World War was, and I quote, the popular craze of the day, as proof that even if Wolf was not reading Freud at this time, she would have known of his ideas. In March 1920, Molly McCarthy set up a club with her husband Desmond to help them write their memoirs. The pair had long been associated with what Leonard Wolfe, writing in the 1960s, described as Old Bloomsbury, and the McCarthys hoped the club would be a way for the group to reform after the interruption of the war years. For the next 3 decades, the group met irregularly for the purpose of reading and discussing memoir. It was to the memoir club that Wolfe shared her memories of childhood abuse at the hands of her stepbrothers, George and Gerald Duckworth, and I'll come back to that later. There was no formal membership of the memoir club, just as there was no formal membership of Bloomsbury itself. However, participants included not only interested readers of Freud, like Leonard Wolfe and Lytton Strachey, but professional exponents too. Virginia's younger brother Adrian trained as a psychoanalyst, as did his wife Karen. Lytton Strachey's brother James studied with and was analysed by Freud in Vienna in the early 1920s. Before returning to London to practice. With his wife Alex, also a trained psychoanalyst, James Strachey joined the London Psychoanalytic Society, and the pair worked on the translation of the 24 volumes of what's still known as the standard edition of Freud's work in English. This was the edition published by Virginia and Leonard Wolfe through their Hogarth Press, which they founded and ran from 1917. The Strachey's translated other European psychoanalytic writing into English, including Carl Abraham, and were instrumental in arranging Melanie Klein's move to London in 1927. In 1925, Klein delivered a series of lectures in 50 Gordon Square, the home of Wolfe's brother, Adrian, and sister-in-law, Karen, an address Wolfe refers to in her diary as next door. The Wolfes met Freud after his move to London, here in this house, in January 1939, and had tea with him. Wolfe describes him in her diary entry for Sunday, January the 29th, as inarticulate, his throat cancer made talking painful, but alert. She reports that he gave her a narcissus. So what impact did Freud have on Virginia Woolf? We have no evidence to suggest Woolf read Freud until July 1939, when she reveals in a letter to John Lehman she has been reading Moses and monotheism. Insofar as she comments directly on psychoanalysis in her diaries and correspondence, it is usually connected to individual practitioners and is almost always scathing. And I'm mindful that one of the epithets of this lecture series is bad women, and there's certainly plenty of deliciously bad behaviour when Wolf writes about the people she knows in her diaries. This is part of an entry for Tuesday, the 21st of November, 1918. Poor James Strachey was soft as moss, lethargic as an earthworm. James proposes to earn his living as an exponent of Freud in Harley Street. For one thing, you can dispense with a degree. Insofar as Wolf comments on Freud's ideas themselves, these too come in for attack. Here she is in a letter. We're publishing all Dr. Freud, and I glance at the proof and read how Mr. A.B. threw a bottle of red ink on the sheets of his marriage bed to excuse his impotence to his housemaid, but threw it in the wrong place, which unhinged his wife's mind, and to this day she pours claret on the dinner table. We could all go on like that for hours, and yet these Germans think it proves something besides their own gull-like imbecility. Nicole Ward-Juve suggests that while there can be no doubt Wolf adopted Freudian insights and even terminology in her writing, we only have to think of her description of the eponymous Orlando driving in her motor car towards the end of that novel, musing on the way all her various selves are, and I quote, commanded and locked up by the captain self to hear echoes of Freud. Juve suggests that what Wolf may have objected to was the elevation of Freud's theories into science. She quotes Wolfe's 1920 review of J.D. Beresford's An Imperfect Mother, titled Freudian Fiction, in which Wolfe stresses the novel's portrayal of the unacknowledged passion between mother and son, written, and I quote, in the inarticulate manner of those who lived before Freud. Wolfe goes on. The triumphs of science are beautifully positive, but for novelists, the matter is much more complex. Yes, says the scientific side of the brain, that explains a good deal. No, says the artistic side of the brain, that is dull and has no human significance. I want to say more about the impact of Freud on Wolf's writing, but before I do, I want to turn to a question that has haunted Wolf's studies, namely why, given that she herself suffered from periods of acute mental illness in her life, did she not consider psychoanalysis as a possible remedy? First, though, I want to say something about Wolf's illness itself, and because it's pertinent both to the title of this lecture series and perhaps to Wolf's difficulty with the increasing medicalization of Freud's ideas about her relationship to her mind doctors. So what do we know about Virginia Woolf's illness? This is how her biographer, Hermione Lee, opens the chapter she labels madness. Virginia Woolf was a sane woman who had an illness. It was periodic and recurrent. It affected her body as much as her mind, and raised the insoluble and fundamental question, which she spent a great deal of time considering, of the relation between the two. 5 times in her life, 4 of them between the ages of 13 and 33, she suffered from major onslaughts of the illness, and in almost all, possibly all, she attempted to kill herself. All 4 of the breakdowns Lee records between the ages of 13 and 33 can be linked to family tragedy or to upheavals in her personal circumstances. Woolf's first breakdown in 1895, when she was 13, happened immediately after her mother, Julia Stevens, premature and probably unnecessary death. Her second, in 1904, followed the death of her father, Leslie Stephen, and the next, in 1910, came after years of family difficulty, including the tragic death of her brother, Toby. Her fourth major breakdown in 1912 occurred a year after her marriage to Leonard Woolfe. In her biography, Lee notes that in addition to these more severe breakdowns, Woolfe was vulnerable to episodes of illness, the symptoms of which might range from sudden and fleeting anxiety to weeks of depression. In addition, she experienced physical symptoms, some of which might in themselves have been separate conditions. Throughout her life, Woolfe suffered acutely from headaches, backache, high temperatures, physical exhaustion, a racing pulse, an aversion to food, and severe weight loss. She was prone to what was diagnosed as influenza. The evidence for Woolfe's illness is contradictory and contains many gaps. There are a number of doctor's letters and a few prescriptions, but no doctor's reports. It was thought that writing during an episode of illness would exacerbate her condition, so we have none of the diary entries or letters that illuminate so much about the rest of Woolfe's life. From 1912 until her death in 1941, the main records for Woolfe's illness are those kept by her husband, Leonard. He wrote minutely detailed and usually daily diary entries on the state of his wife's health, some of which he disguised in Tamil and Sinhalese, which he had learned while serving in present-day Sri Lanka as a British civil servant. He also wrote about Woolfe's illness in letters and in a series of later memoirs. Yet, as Lee notes in her biography, there is very little sense in any of these accounts of what it was like to be Virginia. While Leonard attempts to write scientifically about his wife's illness, documenting her behaviour, setting out its probable causes, listing its treatments, he does so from a particular vantage point. This was his belief that her illness was intimately linked to her creative gifts, was brought on by her intense work levels and the stress of finishing a book, and could be managed by a strict regimen of rest and food. In this, Leonard was influenced by the doctors who treated Virginia. Perhaps the most powerful among these was Sir George Savage, whose conviction that neurasthenic female patients should be prescribed complete rest and a heavy diet, including 4 or 5 pints of milk a day, formed the basis for much of Virginia Woolf's treatment. And Savage is the Dr. Woolf parodies to such terrifying effect in her portrayal of the doctors responsible for tending the shell-shocked war veteran Septimus Warren Smith in Mrs. Dalloway. Wolfe was also prescribed medication, some of which may well have exacerbated or even caused a number of her symptoms. Lee points out, for instance, that according to prescriptions dating from 1919 and 1932, Wolfe was taking Digitalis mixed with potassium bromide, which, if taken in sufficient quantity, can produce a deadening effect not unlike depression. Wolfe, as I've said, rarely wrote during her illnesses. In accordance with George Savage's theory, paper and pen were strictly rationed. Here is one of the few exceptions. It's her diary entry for Wednesday, the 15th of September, 1926. Woke up, perhaps at 3. Oh, it's beginning, it's coming, the horror, physically like a painful wave swelling about the heart, tossing me up, down. God, I wish I were dead. Pause. But why am I feeling like this? Let me watch the wave rise. I watch. Vanessa, children, failure. Yes, I detect that. Failure, failure. The wave rises. Oh, they laughed at my taste in green paint. Wave crashes. I wish I were dead. I've only a few more years to live, I hope. I can't face this horror any more. This is the wave spreading out over me. This goes on several times with varieties of horror. Then, at the crisis, instead of pain remaining intense, it becomes rather vague. I doze, I wake with a start. The wave again, the irrational pain, the sense of failure, generally some specific incident. As, for example, my taste in green paint. At last, I say, watching as dispassionately as I can, now take a pull of yourself. I brace myself to shove, to throw, to batter down. I begin to march blindly forward. I feel obstacles go down. I say it doesn't matter. Nothing matters. I become rigid and straight and sleep again and half wake and feel the wave beginning to and watching the light whitening and wonder how, this time, breakfast and daylight will overcome it. She concludes this diary entry with a question. Does everyone go through this state? One of many moving things about this passage is the endeavour to try and make sense of what's happening. Later in her life, Wolfe would adopt the term autoanalysis to describe this. And as various commentators have observed, Wolfe's sense that her illness is somehow connected to a failure in her self-control is a constant theme in her writing about it. Here is another diary entry, this time for Monday, the 8th of August, 1921. The entry begins with Wolfe noting that for the past 60 days she's written nothing in her diary. 60 days spent in wearisome headache, jumping pulse, aching back, frets, fidgets, lying awake, sleeping draughts, sedatives, digitalis, going for a little walk and plunging back into bed again. All the horrors of the dark cupboard of illness once more displayed for my diversion. Let me make a vow that this shall never, never happen again. That last line, with its implication that she can avoid illness by an act of will, is then followed by this phrase, and then let me confess that there are some compensations. She goes on to relate that these 60 days have given her chance to take stock, and adds, and I quote, "The dark underworld has its fascination as well as its terrors." These reports, both written close to an episode of illness, are rare in Wolfe. And even this last report, penned immediately after a 60-day period, still has the marks of hindsight. Her illness is already contained in metaphor, the horrors she has experienced tided into that dark cupboard. So let me look at the evidence for Freud's influence on Wolf. From the mid-1910s on, his thinking and vocabulary become increasingly apparent in her work, and I want to focus on a specific example. Freud's insistence on the father as the instrument of severance in the mother-child bond echoes through the opening of Wolf's 1927 novel, To the Lighthouse. It begins with a depiction of young James Ramsay's feeling of bliss, sitting by his mother's side, cutting out pictures from an illustrated catalogue. She promises him there will be a trip to the lighthouse tomorrow, as long as the weather is fine. At this point, James' father, Mr. Ramsay, appears. Here are the lines. "But," said his father, stopping in front of the drawing-room window, "it won't be fine." Had there been an axe handy, a poker, or any weapon that would have gashed a hole in his father's breast and killed him, there and then James would have seized it. Numerous commentators have traced a clear evocation of Freud's theory of the Oedipal struggle between father and son, where the pair vie for possession of the mother in this opening. James' father is even described in terms that conjure the castrating phallus. He is, and I quote, "lean as a knife, narrow as the blade of one," as he bears down on his son. And yet, as Ward Juve observes, the resolution of this Oedipal struggle does not follow classical Freudian lines in Wolf's novel. Mrs. Ramsay, James' mother, dominates the first third of the narrative, but then dies suddenly, and in parentheses, in the short middle section, time passes. Juve points out that Mr. Ramsay behaves more like a rivalrous child than a law-bearing Freudian father, demanding reassurance and sympathy not only from his wife, but, as the narrative unfolds, from other females such as Lily Briscoe and even his own daughters. Elizabeth Abel suggests that Wolfe's preoccupation with the mother may have been influenced by her reading of anthropologist Jane Harrison. Abel points out that Freud's Totem and Taboo, which sees the Oedipus complex and subsequent incest taboo at work in the ritual murder of male tribal rulers, relied on the studies of some, and not necessarily the best, anthropologists. One of those he admitted, she argues, was Jane Harrison, whose findings draw attention to the primary importance of the mother. Let me fast forward now to 1939, which is the year we know Wolf read Freud. She began with Moses and monotheism and went on to read Civilization and Its Discontents, Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego, his essay Thoughts for the Time on War and Death, and Why War?, a pamphlet published in 1933, which contained an exchange of letters between Freud and Einstein. Lee suggests that Wolf's arguments in her anti-war polemic Three Guineas, which she published in 1938, were sharpened by her reading of Freud, and in particular, his belief in the inherently aggressive and destructive impulses of humankind. In the notes Wolf made for the essay, Thoughts on Peace in an Air Raid, published in 1940, she asks the question, "What does Hitler mean?" and answers, "Aggression, the subconscious desire to impose our will." Lee points out that in the final version of this essay, Wolf's analysis of the way repression and inhibition curb our primal impulses is indebted to Freud. I called this talk Virginia Woolf and the Perils of Hindsight because I wanted to draw attention to the fact that so much of what we say about Woolf derives from the position we write from. I want now to turn back to Woolf's so-called madness and to present two plausible but divergent interpretations of it as a further example of how what we think we know about Woolf is always tangled up with the time of writing, as well as our own beliefs, preferences, and aims. The first commentator I want to mention is Louise DeSalvo, who wrote an influential book on Woolf in which she interprets her illness in the light of the abuse Woolf received at the hands of her two stepbrothers, George and Gerald Duckworth. Amongst her evidence for this, DeSalvo cites two short autobiographical pieces Woolf wrote for the Memoir Club. In the first, called 22 Hyde Park Gate, the London address where Woolf lived until the death of her father, Leslie Stephen, in 1904, and probably read to the Memoir Club on the 17th of November 1920, Woolf describes George Duckworth's repeated visits to her bedroom at night, his flinging himself on her bed and proceeding to embrace her. In the second, entitled A Sketch of the Past, written in 1939 while Woolf was reading Freud, Woolf's focus switches to her stepbrother Gerald, recalling how he lifted her up as a young girl of six or seven onto a ledge and proceeded to explore her private parts. For DeSalvo, Woolf's madness can be traced to the psychic trauma of these abuses, as well as to the dysfunctional nature of virtually all Woolf's immediate family. Ward Juve points out that DeSalvo was writing in the 1980s, when the extent of child sexual abuse, in the United States at least, was becoming apparent. The other commentator I want to bring in briefly is more recent. K. Redfield Jameson's Touched with Fire, Manic Depressive Illness and the Artistic Temperament was published in 1996, nearly a decade after DeSalvo. Jameson is a clinical psychologist specialising in bipolar disorder from which she suffers and a professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University. I've chosen Jameson as an example of how more recent hindsights into Woolf's illness involve a much greater degree of scientific knowledge. Jameson makes this clear in her introduction, signalling her intention to deploy, and I quote, "the considerable recent advances in genetics, neuroscience, and psychopharmacology," using what she terms formal psychiatric diagnostic criteria, Jameson reviews Woolf's case history, including Leonard's careful notes of his wife's eating, insomnia, and other symptoms, as a modern-day medic. While her book is attentive to the particular incidents that might act as triggers at different points in Woolf's life, her overriding conclusion, based on the insanity traceable in Woolf's family, Woolf's half-sister Laura was indeed shut up in an asylum, is that what she diagnoses as Woolf's manic depressive or bipolar disorder was primarily a matter of genes. I want to end this talk about my own brand of hindsight, which, as Dawn mentioned, has involved writing a work of fiction about the relationship between Virginia Woolf and her painter sister, Vanessa Bell. As Dawn mentioned, for the past decade, I've been involved in editing Woolf's writing, a project which led me to read, or reread, not only everything Woolf wrote, but a great deal concerning her, including her almost daily correspondence with Vanessa. The more I read, of course, the more questions I found I had. Questions to which the available materials could not supply answers. I started this talk by quoting Wolfe searching for a means to portray her character in a railway carriage, Mrs. Brown. I chose to write a novel because it seemed to me to offer a more ethical arena for exploring what we don't and can't know. Fiction does not claim to tell the truth, but it can perhaps approach it differently, through the senses, imagination, and empathy. Curiously, hindsight became a strategy in shaping the narrative I went on to write. One of the problems I encountered straight away was the impossibility of fitting all the facts together in chronological order in a work of fiction. An example of this is the death of Vanessa and Virginia's beloved half-sister Stella in 1897, just a year and a half after their mother, Julia Stevens' death. If I'd been writing a biography, I might simply have treated the devastating effect the two deaths had on the young sisters. But in a novel, it felt like overload. Try as I might, I couldn't find a way to make these two tragic events coming one after another work. It felt strained and paradoxically untrue. So I decided to begin the novel with Vanessa thinking back over her relationship with Virginia. This meant I could use Vanessa's memories to structure the narrative, and so was not obliged to present events chronologically. It also meant I could be selective and had the added advantage that memory frequently muddles or embroiders what happened, thereby distancing my fictional treatment further from the actual historical record. I'll read the opening, which introduces us to Vanessa looking back over her life with Virginia. I'm lying on my back on the grass. Toby is lying next to me, his warm flank pressing into my side. My eyes are open, and I'm watching the clouds, tracing giants, castles, fabulous winged beasts as they chase each other across the sky. Something light tickles my cheek. I raise myself onto my elbow and catch hold of the grass stalk in Toby's hand. He jerks away from me, and soon we're pummeling and giggling until I scarcely know which of the tumbling legs and arms are Toby's and which are mine. When we stop at last, Toby's face is on my chest. His hair is golden in the sunlight, and as I look up, I see the blazing whiteness of an angel. A shadow falls. My angel disappears. I recognize your snake-green eyes. You want to lie between us, but when I push you away, you jump up and whisper in Toby's ear. He lifts his head and looks at you. I see from his expression that your words have captured him. I know you will lure him away with one of your daredevil plans. I lift my head from the page and look out of the window. Sunlight shivers on the glass. For a moment I think I see your face, impish, grinning at me as I write. The light dissolves, and I'm left staring at the empty pane. My memories are as tangled as the reels of thread and fragments of cloth in Mother's sewing basket, which I loved to tip out and sort on the nursery floor. Writing Vanessa and Virginia was an opportunity to explore the close, loving, but sometimes rivalrous relationship that existed between the two sisters. While the boys of the family were sent away to school and their father and mother preoccupied with multiple pressing demands on their time, the pair grew up spending most hours of most days alone in each other's company. They plotted their futures together, and Vanessa writes very movingly how, when her own son Julian was tragically killed in the Spanish Civil War in 1937, it was Virginia who saved her. Vanessa was proud of her younger sister's growing reputation, and also, on occasion, jealous of it. Virginia, on the other hand, openly craved attention and affection from her older sister, and was miserable whenever Vanessa was away for any length of time. At the same time, she flirted outrageously with Vanessa's husband, Clive, and was envious of Vanessa's two sons, and perhaps especially her daughter, Angelica. I'll read a short second passage from the novel, which explores some of this sibling tension. The passage is set during the excruciating ritual of afternoon tea, which the young Vanessa and Virginia were required to attend, and to which guests were frequently invited. It comes after Julius Stephen's death, and an aunt is trying to cheer the grief-stricken Leslie. And I should just add that by this stage, it was already clear to both sisters that while Vanessa was going to be a painter, Virginia would write. "It's the fact that she must stand," Aunt Minna puts her cup down on the table. Her starched collar crackles as she reaches for the pot. "Another for you, Leslie?" Father's only response is a grunt. For the past half hour, he has sat staring into the space ahead of him, his silence broken only by the occasional groan. Aunt Minna has not yet abandoned her aim of trying to cheer him, and interprets his grunt as a yes. "Pass me your father's cup, will you, Virginia? There's a dear." You glare at Aunt Minna, and I see you have taken her silly observation to heart. Aunt Minna prattles on. "Writing seems to me a much better activity for a woman. The body is supported, and as long as one makes sure to sit up straight, there's no pressure on the back. I can't think it can be good for Vanessa to have to stand all day before an easel. Have you thought, dear, of the impact on your posture?" I ignore Aunt Minna. I know what she says is kindly meant. I watch you pick up Father's cup and pass it to her. There's no mistaking the look of fury on your face. Only later do I realise the extent of your anger. For your birthday, you ask Father for a lectern so you can write standing up. Yet another reason why fiction seemed an appropriate medium in which to explore the lives of Wolfe and Bell was the opportunity it gives to make its own fictional nature apparent. Here's Vanessa coming to the end of her memoir. There are daffodils on her desk, which she's thinking about painting. There, it's done. I tie the pages together and go out into the hall to put on my jacket and boots. I walk to the river and kneel down on the bank. I untie my parcel and dip the first sheet in the water. The words blur. I wait until the paper is soaked so that it won't be blown away by the wind, then let it go. The current snatches it from my fingers and rushes it downstream. Only when all the pages have been released do I make my dedication. This story is for you. I walk home slowly and enter the garden by the back gate. My eye is caught by a blaze of daffodils under the apple trees. I decide to bring my easel outside and paint these instead. I gaze at the yellow, vivid and tangible in the sunlight. You are right. What matters is that we do not stop creating. So I want to conclude by returning to Virginia Woolf and to a final anecdote from her about the perils of hindsight. In 1936, at the age of 54, Woolf was asked by her friend Violet Dickinson if she would like to see some of the letters she had sent Violet as a young woman. Two bound volumes containing typed copies of these letters duly arrived, together with photographs. These mementos of a former self had a profound effect on Woolf. She found the letters difficult reading at times, to the point that she had to set them aside. And she was shocked by just how much she had forgotten. Perhaps the strongest feeling, though, was one of alienation and even disapprobation as she looked back at that younger self. "Do you like that girl?" she asked Violet, adding, "I'm not sure that I do." Thank you very much.